Okay, let's go back on the record.
Public staff calls Dustin Metz to the stand.
Do you want to be affirmed or sworn?
Either will.
Okay. Put your left hand on the Bible. Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give this afternoon will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Mr. Metz, would you please state your name, title, and business address for the record?
My name is Dustin Ray Metz. My title, I'm an engineer in electric section of operations and planning in the public staff's energy division. My business address is 430 North Salisbury Street, Raleigh, North Carolina.
Thank you. And did you cause to be pre-filed in this proceeding 36 pages of direct testimony plus an Appendix A of your education experience and two exhibits on October 26, 2021?
Yes.
Presiding Commissioner, we ask that Mr. Metz's pre-filed testimonies be copied into the record as if delivered orally from the stand, and that his pre-filed exhibits be marked for identification as shown in the pre-filed exhibits.
Without objection, that is allowed.
Mr. Metz, do you have any changes to your pre-filed testimony or exhibits?
I do not.
If I ask you the same questions today on the witness stand, would your responses be the same as the answers you have pre-filed?
Yes, they would.
Mr. Metz, would you please provide a summary of your testimony?
The purpose of my testimony provided the commission with the results of the public staff's investigation on Juno Solar's application for a 275 megawatt AC merchant power plant. Public staff recommends that the commission deny the CPCN without prejudice and allow Juno to refile its application once it obtains a completed facility study. A completed facility study would allow the public staff and the commission to evaluate a reasonably known impact estimate of potential transmission upgrades to maintain the safety and reliability of the bulk electric system. Juno is seeking to interconnect into a known constrained area of Duke Energy Progress transmission system and sell the output of the facility to an off-taker in PJM. Duke Energy Progress has not completed a power flow analysis or any other interconnection study, and Juno's proposed condition fails to address the magnitude or total cost of the required upgrades to allow interconnection of Juno or a combination of multiple projects. The public staff disagrees with the characterization of the cluster study process as a catch-22. It is simply a business decision that the applicant has to make, like other generating facilities participating in the Transition Cluster Study, TCS, or Definitive Interconnection Study Process, DISIS. The TCS is a voluntary process for the transition from serial studies to large-scale cluster studies approved by two state commissions and the FERC. Under the TCS process, which Juno has entered into, the applicant does not need a CPCN to progress through the TCS process. Juno will have the opportunity to apply for a CPCN once the upgrade costs are known. Should that be contested proceeding that impacts the timing to start the construction of the facility, Juno also has the right to file a request of limited construction. The levelized cost of transmission metric, aka LCOT, is not a pass-fail test. LCOT is a factor to be considered, along with other factors like the total magnitude of cost and potential impacts to the transmission system. A position that the public staff has consistently taken in testimony in multiple other merchant plant CPCN dockets. The need for the power in the state and the region must also be balanced against the cost and the long-term planning for the state as the commission considers whether a facility meets the public convenience and necessity pursuant to North Carolina General Statute 62-110.1. I listed in my testimony the applicant's proposed condition of a $4 megawatt hour LCOT rate impacts to North Carolina retail and wholesale. See my testimony, Metz Table 2. While Table 2 is illustrative to see that the rate impacts of approximately 0.09% North Carolina retail impact and a 2.29% wholesale impact, noting that this rate impact does not factor in the total magnitude of other projects that may seek interconnection in the first ever transitional cluster study process. Fundamentally, Public staff believes that the applicant is seeking a certificate too early in the process. The public staff first proposed a stay until the costs are known. The commission denied the request for a stay, and we believe the next best alternative is denial without prejudice. Juneau is the only merchant plant in the TCS seeking a CPCN at this early stage, and we believe that the commission will be in a better position to evaluate the application once the interconnection study results are available from the TCS. This completes my summary.
Thank you, Mr. Metz. The witness is available for cross-examination.
Good afternoon, Mr. Metz.
Good afternoon.
So, Mr. Metz, counsel for the public staff in the cross-examination of Mr. Levitas and Ms. Miller discussed some filings that were made before this commission and before FERC regarding Q reform. Do you recall that?
Yes.
So they referenced the this commission's approval in the E-100 sub 101 docket of Q reform?
Yes.
And also FERC's order approving Q reform, the Duke's FERC jurisdictional Q reform process. Is that right?
I'm generally aware of them, yes.
Okay. So would you agree that CPCN procedures for FERC jurisdictional projects were not at issue in the E-100 sub 101 docket?
That is correct. My general understanding of the transitional cluster process, whether it was the NCIP or the LGIA or LGIP, the CPCNs was not a consideration. The consideration was how to transition the queue.
Okay. And the changes to the procedures that this commission considered in the sub 101 docket related solely to state jurisdictional projects, right?
That is correct.
Okay. And wouldn't you agree that FERC would have no business weighing in on issues related to the issuance of CPCNs by this commission?
I can't speculate on what FERC evaluated.
Okay. Well, would you agree that it's not within FERC's jurisdiction to rule on the procedures for issuance of a CPCN by this commission?
Objection. I don't think the witness should have to speculate on FERC's jurisdictional limit.
Fair enough. Well, let me ask you this. It's not the public staff's position that because the solar industry, CCEBA, supported Duke's Q reform proposals before this commission and before FERC, that Juneau Solar should be barred from raising this catch-22 issue in this docket, is it?
My testimony is not preventing Juneau from raising this supposed catch-22 issue.
Okay, so it's not the public staff's position that CCEBA's support for the Q reform proposals prevents Juneau Solar from raising what it believes is this catch-22 issue in this docket, is that right?
Are you asking, sorry to ask a question on the question, I'm trying to seek clarification. Are you asking what was discussed during the stakeholder process, or are you asking what's before an application?
Not at all. I'm just trying to understand the public staff's position on this issue. Does the public staff maintain that because CCEBA supported and other members of the industry supported Q reform proposals, that Juneau Solar shouldn't be able to raise this supposed catch-22 issue in the CPCN docket?
I mean, it's their application, they can raise what they want.
Okay, thank you. So, Mr. Metz, you testify that you do not believe that Juneau Solar has demonstrated a need for the facility, is that right?
Could you point to exactly in my testimony?
Sure, I can point you to page 28 of your direct testimony, of your testimony.
Thank you, one second. So yes, on the bottom of page 8, after 14, lines 14 through 16, taking in context the entire question and answer starting on line 4 through 13, yet based on my review, the PJM interconnection queue, the applicant has not demonstrated a need for the facility or that it has to be located in the DP service territory to serve PJM.
Okay, well let's take the first part of that where you say that the applicant has not demonstrated the need for the facility. What's your basis for concluding that the applicant hasn't demonstrated the need for the facility?
Well, an emphasis that facility is uppercase, so it's just saying the Juneau facility specifically, is that given the amount of carbon-free generation within the PJM queues that I've reviewed in other EMP applications. There are numerous amounts of other generation that can serve what PJM has identified as energy and capacity needs.
So what I'm hearing you say is that PJM's got, there are plenty of carbon-free projects in PJM's queue, and so this facility is not necessary?
I'm not saying it's not necessary, I'm just saying the amount of energy that could be procured could also be procured from other resources. It does not have to be solely from this project, this facility within the DEP service territory.
So because, I'm trying to understand, so is it your position that the Juneau facility is not the sole viable source for carbon-free generation in PJM, there's not a need for it in PJM?
I mean, I believe I stated earlier was that there is a need for energy and capacity in PJM. However, PJM has not identified that the only place that they can get it from is this facility or Juneau Solar.
Well, PJM itself doesn't identify needs for capacity comprehensively, does it? I mean, it's a market, isn't it?
It is a market, that is correct.
Okay. So would it be fair to say that it is buyers within PJM who identify needs for energy and capacity?
I'm just getting hung up on a little bit in the context of the word need. If to the extent that if a buyer wanted the energy or capacity for their carbon reduction goals, then it would facilitate a market decision.
Okay. So if there is a market decision to procure energy and capacity from this facility, would you agree that there is a need for the facility?
Based upon my understanding of the applicant and the non-binding, being careful because it's the non-binding agreement, that there is a need for carbon-free generation.
Okay, so it's your understanding that there's a need for carbon-free generation. Is there a need for this facility?
I believe my testimony has answered this.
Okay. But you do agree that there is a demonstrated need for energy and capacity in PJM, is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. So the public staff has considered CPCN applications for a number of other merchant plants that plan to sell into PJM. Are you familiar with those?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so these would include the Timber Mill Wind Project in EMP 118, is that right?
That is correct.
Okay, and that would include American Beach Solar?
That is correct.
Okay. Just to name a couple of them. So would you agree that in each case where a merchant facility has announced its backup, would you agree that where merchant facilities applying for CPCNs have stated that they intend to sell into PJM, in every such case, the public staff has either agreed that there was a demonstrated need for the facility or not taken a position on the need issue. Do you agree with that?
Yes, and we did not recommend denial of this facility based upon the need element. We recommended a deny without prejudice based upon the facilities coming in too premature, and the public staff would need to evaluate the transmission cost once the incumbent utility or the transmission owner, in this case Duke Energy Progress, completed their power flow analysis.
Understood. We'll get to that, but I'm really trying to focus on your conclusion that there is not a demonstrated need for the facility. Prior to this proceeding, the public staff has never taken the position that a merchant plant selling into PJM has not demonstrated a need for that facility. Is that right?
I'm trying to get through the multiple EMPs through my head, and explicitly the ones that I've filed testimony on, but subject to check, yes.
Okay. And the commission has granted CPCNs to merchant plants that intend to sell into PJM, hasn't it?
I cannot recall all the EMP applications, but yes, I do believe there are some.
Okay, and so would you agree that in the Edgecombe Solar case, the commission granted a CPCN based in part on the fact that Edgecombe Solar was planning to sell into PJM?
Yes.
OK. Okay, and the same could be said of the Fern Solar application? Is that right?
Subject to check.
Okay, and the same could be said of the Halifax County Solar application, is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. And more recently, the commission concluded that the Oak Trail Solar Project had demonstrated a need based on sales at the PJM, is that right?
Subject to check.
Okay. So in short, I mean, wouldn't you agree that in the eyes of both the public staff and the commission, up to now, merchant plants selling into PJM have consistently been able to demonstrate a need for the facility?
Up to now, for the projects that have tried to sell into PJM have been located within the PJM footprint. So this facility created a extraneous wrinkle when it is a project trying to locate within Duke Energy Progress and then sell the energy into Duke, into PJM.
Okay, well, this is getting to something important. I'm trying to understand why in prior cases the public staff has always supported, or at least not opposed, a showing of need, and in this case the public staff has come to the conclusion that there's not a need for the facility. And what I think I'm hearing from you is that there's not a need for the facility because it's located in DEP. Is that an accurate characterization of your testimony?
No, accurate characterization of my testimony is on lines 14 through 16. Based on my review of the PJM interconnection queue, the applicant has not demonstrated the need for the facility or that it has to be located in DEP service territory to serve PJM.
Okay, so is it your testimony or your view that you're not contesting that there may be a need for the facility's output in PJM, it's just that it hasn't shown that it needs to be located in DEP?
That's a fair characterization, yes.
Okay, on what basis have you concluded that the facility needs to show that it must be located in DEP to serve that need?
Well, in part of the evaluation, we'll be looking at the overall transmission impacts to the system. So in this particular case, Duke Energy Progress, through the crediting policy, Duke Energy Progress ratepayers would ultimately be responsible for any transmission upgrades that need to take place or their allocation through TCS accordingly. So again, this creates a unique circumstance when to evaluate the overall project.
Okay, so I think I'm hearing you say that your position on need is driven by the fact that Juno may trigger upgrades that would get reimbursed by DEP's ratepayers. Is that right?
Not solely, no.
Okay.
But the facts and circumstances on this specific application is that they are locating within Duke Energy Progress.
Okay, so is it the location of the project within DEP that drives your conclusion about the need for the project?
Not in isolation, no. Or if the project was located within PJM, the project could direct sell to PJM, just as the other EMPs that you have made mention of, and then the aspects of it having to evaluate the transmission system, regardless of which utility is responsible for, may be somewhat minimized with the factor of affected system studies, of course.
Okay, well, let me ask it another way. Why should the commission care whether this facility is located in with regard to the issue of need, what is the relevance of this project being located in DEP or in PJM, if it can sell into PJM either way?
I mean, I feel like I've answered this 3 or 4 times now.
Okay, well, bear with me because I'm slower. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, this is the application. The applicant, Juno Solar, did not demonstrate that in order to serve PJM's forecasted needs, it has to come from the Juno facility. And the public staff did not recommend denial based upon need. This is an observation.
All right, let me ask it another way. If there was no possibility that there would be reimbursable upgrades for the Juno project, would you have found that there was a need for the project?
The public staff would still evaluate the transmission impacts regardless of whose cost responsibility they are.
Okay. Ms. Miller testifies in her rebuttal testimony that Juno has executed a term sheet for a large investment grade retail and wholesale energy provider in PJM. Did you ever hear her testimony about that?
Yes, the non-binding term sheet, yes.
Okay. You do not, is it your position that having executed a non-binding term sheet does not demonstrate need for the project?
It's non-binding, it can change.
Are you familiar with the Timber Mill Wind project, which is currently seeking a CBCN and docket number EMP 118 sub-zero?
Mr. Thomas was the lead engineer from the public staff. I'm generally familiar with the overall application, but not the specifics of it.
Are you aware that in that case, the public staff found that there was a demonstrated need for the project, even though the project did not have a contract for the sale of its output?
I would have to defer to the testimony or what's in the record.
So in her rebuttal testimony, Ms. Miller testifies about the transmission charges that Juno Solar will have to pay to wheel its output into PJM. And did you hear the testimony on that this morning?
Yes, I did.
Okay. And merchant projects that are located in PJM do not have to pay those charges to DEP, do they?
So if a project is located within PJM and they are not wheeling through Duke Energy Progress, then no, they would not pay Duke Energy Progress a wheeling charge.
Okay, thank you. And even if projects in PJM triggered upgrades, affected system upgrades on Duke's system, they still wouldn't have to pay transmission charges to Duke, is that right?
If your question was they would not have to pay wheeling charges, that would be correct, because if in terms of an affected system, depending on how everything going on with American Beach and the appeals,
right,
and all that, and Duke's oath on reimbursement, they could pay the transmission costs depending on the outcome of that appeal. But the wheeling charge, there would be no wheeling charges.
Okay. Well, they could pay the costs, the upfront cost of those upgrades, is that right?
So clarification, if we are talking about the affected system element of a PJM project into affected system on Duke Energy Progress with a executed affected system operating agreement, which has the milestone provisions within it, the applicant would pay Duke Energy Progress those costs, and after commercial operation and upon mutual agreed upon terms between Duke Energy Progress and the applicant in that case, there would be a reimbursement or, is my understanding, a potential transmission credit.
Okay, thank you. But no wheeling charges of the kind that Juno is going to have to pay to Duke, is that right?
That is correct.
So Ms. Miller testified that Birch Creek projects that Juno will pay more than $275 million in wheeling charges to DEP over the life of the project. Would you agree that those revenues provide a benefit to DEP and its ratepayers?
So the wheeling charges and the wheeling charging revenues, or through the ATRR revenues, is slightly complex. I'm going to try to answer to the best of my abilities from an engineering perspective. I'll greatly defer if the commission had further questions from an accounting perspective, that the public staff would make those resources available, or even Duke Energy's. I am not an accountant. I get a little bit lost in the revenues and how they flow, so I'll try to answer it to the best of my abilities. So through the wheeling charges, the one element that created some difficulties in calculating it, well, first and foremost, the public staff initiated discovery on this because we thought there would be or could be a revenue to ratepayers to potentially apply against or offset the LCOT. So this was initiated, just like we do in avoided costs, we try to find increments and decrements. As we all know, the interconnection process continues to evolve, so does our understanding of the overall process. So we evaluated the wheeling charges and sought discovery from the applicant on this matter. So one element that started to create some complexity in evaluating this was the optionality of the project. as we heard today, is that, well, on one hand, they could sell into PJM. Well, under that hypothetical, I'll come back to non-firm and firm, because there is a cost difference, and that can be found on Duke's OASIS website, publicly available. How do we start evaluating that? So under what revenue stream? Can I say right now that if an applicant proposed optionality, that we have a non-binding agreement, but we could do something else with it later or at any point up to execution, I found it extremely difficult to, not the calculation itself, provide weight that would actually be a revenue offset to the overall calculation. So just optionality in itself created difficulty summarizing. Moving to the second point versus firm versus non-firm. I believe we've heard reference to public staff data request 213 and using the spreadsheet that the company provided, in that they listed 175 megawatts of what they were prescribing, not that they have to do it, not that a conditional CPCN can make them do it, 175 megawatts, and were able to calculate the firm point-to-point service. So yes, using the company's spreadsheet, and before I start spamming, it's non-confidential, correct? I believe we released it, but I've heard some conflicting.
Yes, okay. It's not confidential.
And I can provide this to the commission as a late filed exhibit as well, with some of the public staff calculations. Under 175 megawatts, firm, point to point, firm being that they are subscribing, that they have rights to move that energy across Duke Energy Progress systems and cannot be curtailed. That's probably under emergency conditions. Is that under 40 years? Yes. $286 million in potential revenue at the escalation rates projected and all assumptions held constant. However, one would have to evaluate the net present value of that. In other words, ratepayers today under a $4 LCOT would be $51 million. You would have to do a net present value of the potential revenues over 40 years. Going out 40 years, there's a lot of assumptions. It's a lot of unknowns. I'll stay away from the word risk. Simplifying discount rate, that equates to $88 million net present value with 175 megawatts firm point to point. Again, to restate, I could not give that any weight given the optionality of the project. A different evaluation that I conducted was that revenue stream from the wheeling charges was not with the upgrades of the $4 LCOT. One would need to add in the potential of the $4 LCOT, which would be $51 million. And so under the initial case would be the base case. And then one would evaluate the additional $51 million injection at year one, simplifying assumptions, and doing a net present value analysis. It went to, instead of 88.2 million, it went to 89.7 million, plus or minus. There's some assumptions in here. The base case and change case demonstrated that only 1.5 million additional revenue would be from the $51 million in upgrade costs, or approximately 1/16. Again, increment and decrement that the public staff has evaluated consistently in multiple dockets. The second part of the evaluation was looking at the non-firm, because again, the application as proposed did not say whether it had to be firm or non-firm. The applicant could elect to do non-firm, using the same assumptions of 40 years, and by the way, I've done this at 15 years, 20 years, and 30 years. The simplifying assumptions with non-firm, the revenues drop in half to approximately $42 million versus the approximately $88 to $89 million. So I know it's a little bit long-winded answer, but on the wheeling charges, it was a lot to okay. discuss there,
yeah,
and the conversation.
And Mr. Snowden, while you think of that, if you will, provide a late file exhibit. Thank you.
Certainly.
Okay. Let's unpack. There are a couple things to unpack in your answer there. The first thing that stood out to me was that you said that you calculated based on Juno's allocation, their statements about the purchase of firm transmission, that the net present value of that $275 million or so would be either $88 million or $89.7 million. Is that right?
Approximately, with the given discount rate at 40 years, if all things manifest themselves.
Okay. So that is higher than the $50 or so million in upgrade costs that would correspond to the $4 LCOT. Is that right?
That is higher, with the caveat that that is under assumption that they would do firm point-to-point service or non-firm point-to-point service over the entire contract length. That they could elect at a different point in time, say at 15 years or 10 years, again, because it's a non-binding term sheet, a different term sheet can be elected into tomorrow. I can't speculate on that nature. But yes, that's why I evaluated at different term lengths.
Do you have any reason to doubt that they would continue to purchase firm transmission service over the life of the project?
Well, I thought I heard today that you evaluate potentially selling the, well, I read in the application that you evaluate, or even in through discovery, that you could sell at any time to Duke Energy Progress as an off-taker, or outright sell the facility to potentially Duke Energy or Duke Energy Progress. So yes, I do have reason to doubt.
But would you agree that if the project were sold to Duke for compliance with, for purposes of meeting the HB 951 goals, that's just an entirely different set of benefits that we'd be looking at, isn't it?
That is, and that's a great question, because under that, we would no longer, ratepayers would no longer be receiving the wheeling revenue to potentially offset the transmission costs.
Okay. I also want to go back to something else you said. You calculated that out of the $88 or $89 million in wheeling charges, only $1 million or so of those charges would go to paying for the upgrades associated with the facility. Is that right?
Under one scenario, looking at the potential, if you would look at the incremental contribution under that concept, then yes, it would only be $1.5 million, but there are multiple assumptions embedded with that, and that may not be the most absolute value to hang your hat on.
Okay, but some portion of the rest of that would go to fund other upgrades to Duke's system, or other capital investments, past or future, in Duke's transmission system, wouldn't it?
And that is true, and with the further clarification is that not just all of the costs through the OAT are for capital. I do not know the percentages, but they are O&M, overhead, and other capital expenditures.
Okay.
And capital expenditures.
Okay. Projects that are located in Duke service territory that sell to Duke do not pay transmission or wheeling charges to Duke. Is that right?
Can you say it again, please?
A project that is located in Duke service territory and that sells to Duke does not pay wheeling charges, right?
It is my understanding if facility hypothetically is located in Duke Energy Progress and direct sells to Duke Energy Progress, then no, there would be no wheeling charges.
Okay, thank you. So Juno Solar has requested that the commission approve its CPCN subject to a condition that if the LCOT of upgrades associated with the project exceeds $4 per megawatt hour, the CPCN will terminate. Is that your understanding?
Yes, that is my understanding.
Now, in your testimony, you do not take any position on the question of whether an LCOT of no more than $4 per megawatt hour is reasonable, do you?
I do not take a position, because the position of my testimony was is that in order for me to provide a recommendation to this commission, that I need a completed facility study with best estimate transmission costs from the transmission owner in order to make the evaluation. Noting that, even those costs, like we saw in Friesian, like we've seen in other EMP applications where I filed testimony, those costs go up and down through multiple times, and even as we had in discovery in this particular case on your project. The public staff data request number 2, looking at question number 7, we asked the question, what class or level estimate would you know consider the $16.84 million estimate? What is the tolerance and range of that estimate? This is a planning or budgetary class estimate based upon the reasonableness and assumptions in line with utility practice and industry standards. This estimate is to have a minus 20 plus 100 variation. These are still preliminary estimates. We accept that there are estimates, but however, I've tried to say, and we said in testimony, I need a completed facility study from the utility, noting that we will have to evaluate those costs at that time and understanding the risk associated with some of those potential upgrades and the level of class estimate. And like I've done in other EMP testimonies, that we will evaluate a range of potential outcomes of magnitudes of cost to evaluate the benchmark and reasonableness on the LCOT metric, which is inclusive of evaluating the magnitude and the nature of the upgrades in themselves.
Isn't Juno Solar asking in this case that the ultimate fate of its CPCN will be determined by the LCOT as shown in the facility study for the project?
So the applicant is requesting, and through, I believe, different clarifications of testimony, because the position has morphed over time or evolved slightly, that the applicant is agreeing that $4 LCOT, all-in cost, if it goes over that, then they will withdraw or revocate their CPCN. That is my understanding of the applicant's request.
Okay. And is it your understanding that Juno is not asking the commission to make a judgment as to what the actual LCOT of the project is based on its current estimates, is it? Let me ask it another way. Juno has asked that the commission set a $4 standard for LCOT for the project, right?
That is correct.
Right. And compliance with that $4 standard is to be measured based on the results of its facility study. Is that right?
I don't know if it was designated that the facility study would be actually setting the benchmark as pass or fail, because that creates another unique issue with the termination provision as proposed, and the conditions somewhat become, it's not problematic, it's not the right word, it becomes very complex to try to solve for, to the extent that the applicant is requesting that the execution of the interconnection agreement should terminate the revocation provisions. Through time and other factors, estimates change, and those costs could go up.
Well, let me ask you this, though. You are not taking the position that the commission should be able to revoke a CPCN based on what the post-construction actual costs of interconnection are you?
No, I'm saying at this time, if we looked at the timing of it, again, we do not have a completed facility study with a level or range of estimate or evaluation of even what the upgrades are. I would have to evaluate the upgrades, the execution of the interconnection agreement, and the types of upgrades, because I remember testifying this on Frisian, and part of the conversation was the multiple river crossings associated with Frisian. Each river crossing, from a project management standpoint and a construction standpoint, is embedded risk. I can't make an informed decision on whether or not the terminating provision should indeed be the IA with the balance of the actual estimation. Because until you put boots on the ground, you don't know what you're going to run into. So if we did a paper version of a evaluation to base the LCOT off of and the metric and all these conditional functions that we want to, that the applicant's trying to request, one may need to evaluate whether that is appropriate in that unique set of facts and circumstances.
So are you telling me that you don't necessarily trust the estimates that are prepared by Duke's interconnection teams for purposes of the interconnection agreement?
No, it's never came out of my mouth.
Okay. Well, I'm asking you, what I think I'm hearing you say is that, well, there's a lot of uncertainty with these IA estimates. The Duke's teams may not have appropriately accounted for risks. I would need to review that myself to determine whether that estimate is reliable. Is that your testimony?
As I'm representing the general consuming public, yes.
Okay. So if you had an interconnection agreement in your hand that said cost of these upgrades is however many dollars equals a $4 LCOT, even at that point, the public staff could not reach a conclusion as to whether the LCOT for the facility was reasonable?
So it starts to become very challenging because, for example, if the $4 LCOT, so I believe the testimony listed that approximately the applicant, through their power flow analysis, estimated that around 17 miles of transmission line will have to be upgraded. I mean, we have seen in other system impact studies within PJM on new EMP applications triggering what they call wreck and rebuild, that basically we could have just invested millions of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars, who knows what the cost on a line for a reliability upgrade last year, 2 years, 5 years, etc. But then a project comes on and says, hey, we need to wreck and rebuild that, not for reliability, because the existing system is okay, it's working, it's per NERC standards, and we need to rebuild that line so ratepayers will be exposed to the undepreciated cost of the existing line plus now the incremental cost. So again, one needs to evaluate exactly what the transmission upgrades will or will not be.
It sounds to me like you're testifying that you don't think that LCOT, well, is it your view that LCOT is not a particularly good metric for the reasonableness of interconnection costs?
I believe it was stated earlier is that LCOT was just one tool in the evaluation of a project.
So in the Friesen docket, you provided testimony about what you thought were appropriate benchmark LCOT values for network upgrades in that case. Is that right?
If you're referencing the LB&L study, that is correct.
Okay. And the LCOT values from the LB&L study were in the range of $1.56 to $3.22 per megawatt hour. Is that right?
That sounds correct, yes.
Okay. And would you agree that since 2019, transmission costs have generally risen?
Generally risen is somewhat vague. Just looking at markets and potential labor costs and other, there's been more upward pressure with them the last year, but yes, I would agree they have generally risen.
Okay. So let me ask you this. Would you agree that as of now, an LCOT of $4 per megawatt hour is not unreasonably out of line with those LCOT figures that are presented in the LB&L study?
That is correct. The public staff does agree that the potential of a $4 LCOT may be the correct metric, but however, until we see a completed facility study from Duke Energy Progress specific to Juno Solar, it's premature to just say that's okay. Because what the one function of the LCOT, well, how people are characterizing LCOT, we're failing to identify the magnitude cost impact. For example, a 5 megawatt project with an LCOT of $4 has a much lower impact to wholesale in North Carolina retail compared to a 275 megawatt project. And as we can see through the TCS cluster that is potentially coming through, there's going to be a magnitude of projects, knowing that at this point in time, we're only seeing the potential of one CPCN, we'd have to evaluate the magnitude of cost.
So, Mr. Metz, what I'm hearing is that you are concerned with the overall magnitude, what I'm hearing is that you are concerned not just with the LCOT from the project, but one of the other factors you're concerned about is the magnitude of the absolute magnitude of the upgrades associated with that project. Is that right?
That is just another element, yes.
Okay. And has the public staff taken a position as to what absolute magnitude of upgrades associated with a single project would be reasonable or unreasonable?
No, because I tried to clarify that earlier on. It's also an embedded function of what the upgrades actually are. So, for example, if under one hypothetical, if it's a wreck and rebuild of a new line we just got done building, we would need to take that in overall consideration. It may not be a failing criteria. It may not be a passing criteria. It's just something that has to be taken in consideration. And these transmission studies are, and these projects are all unique in nature.
Well, let me ask you this. In prior merchant plant CPCN dockets, has the public staff taken a close look at the exact nature of the upgrades at issue when in his recommended approval of those CPCNs?
One second. So it might serve the commission that we answered this question and a data request from the applicant in DR1. Specifically question 8. Question 8, public staff witness met states that the commission cannot make a full informed decision on the application until it's been studied. Fast forwarding, please identify all CPCN proceedings, including applications for utility construct facilities, which public staff has taken a position that the commission should not render a decision. So in that response, I go through each one of the applications, inclusive of EMPs and utility-owned generation. I'm not going to reread it. I mean, we're happy to provide the commission this response unless they want me to go in more detail in each one of the dockets.
Looking at these,
Mr. Stone, okay. If I could interrupt, we would like that in a late filed exhibit, please.
Commissioner Duffley, I can go ahead and request that this data request be marked for identification as applicant's cross-examination exhibit 1,
so that
you can all see it. Yeah.
And let's mark that Metz cross-examination.
Metz. Yes, ma'am.
Number 1.
Thank you. Thank you.
And then looking at how we've marked the public staff, we'll call it the Juno Metz cross exhibit number 1, keep consistent with the public staff records.
Okay, so Mr. Metz, has everybody got a copy of that now? Looking at the public staff's response to data request 8, there are several dockets here. With the exception of the EMP 92 docket, these are all dockets relating to CPCNs for utility constructed or approved units. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. And would you agree that the utility has got a much greater access to information about the nature of the upgrades that will be required for a facility than an interconnection customer does?
Well, I mean, an interconnection customer, once they have a completed system impact study and a facility study from the utility, they should have a degree of insight into the overall upgrades. My apologies, I am looking for the EMP applications. Oh, exactly. So on page 12 of my testimony, we also go into great detail, especially footnote 9 of the multiple EMP applications. So my apologies, Mr. Snow, I didn't know. Only answered the utility-owned and not the merchant plant aspect in the previous question.
Okay, well, I was just asking about the utility-owned ones. So referencing your footnote 9 here on page 12 of your testimony, that references instances in which the public staff has requested that additional information about costs, network upgrade costs, be provided to the commission. Is that right?
That is correct. And as you can go to the PGM website, on each one of those individual EMP applications, you can see the completed, there's three studies. Hold on. I forget the first one. It's FC, but then system impact study, and then the equipment facility study. And some of the conversations that we've had in the previous EMP applications, especially EMP 102 sub 1, which is before this commission, that was there's been multiple filings in that testimony, so I lose track of which one, but at one point in that time is the public staff could not make a recommendation similar to Juno Solar, is that we did not have a completed effective system study for the second part of the overall project, which is, in my opinion, almost identical to what is going here before Juno. We just cannot make a recommendation on a cost that we don't know what it is, or the nature of the upgrades that we don't know what it is.
So you believe that the commission needs to have complete information about all the upgrades that will be required for a project before a CPCN can be granted?
I believe the facility study is the utility's best effort to provide insight in the nature and the cost of the upgrades.
So Mr. Metz, you also say in your testimony that it's the aggregate cost to ratepayers of upgrades in the transitional cluster study that's important. Is that a fair characterization of your testimony?
I don't know if I said important. If you can point to a point you're referencing.
I'm afraid I don't have a citation off the top of my head here. Would you agree that you testify that the commission must consider the aggregate cost of all of the upgrades triggered by the transitional cluster study before it can act on Juno CPCN?
Similar to when I was looking at the on impact rates, just going on page 30 on table 1 and then the results on table 2, I believe the public staff would, and I believe the commission would also evaluate the total rate impacts in whole. So when one evaluates certain particular projects, the rate impacts could go up, and in other circumstances, they may not.
Okay. So let me ask you this, because I'm trying to understand how this is going to work, or how the public staff sees this as working. So if a group of projects in the transitional cluster were to collectively impose upgrade costs that the public staff believed were unreasonable, should the commission just deny CPCNs for all of those projects?
My immediate answer would be no, with the caveat that that's sort of an open-ended question, because I would have to know the nuances or the specifications of each individual project. For example, if they are state jurisdictional projects seeking CPCNs or interconnection through the TCS, those costs would not be borne by ratepayers. They would be borne by, for lack of a better word, the market participants or the individual investor.
Well, let's limit it to just for jurisdictional projects that whose upgrade costs might be reimbursed by ratepayers. If a group of FERC jurisdictional projects in the transitional cluster collectively resulted in upgrades that the public staff thought was unreasonably large in the aggregate, what should the commission do with that information? Should it deny CPCNs to all the projects that it has before it?
One would have to evaluate the overall project, because under that potential hypothetical, that is the assumption that all the projects are independent. There could be, again, hypothetical, that there may be non-project interdependencies, two projects on opposite ends of the system, or even near part of the system, depending on the injection of where they're putting out on the topology of the system that given time, they could be not interdependent, and they could be viewed in overall isolation. But again, in DEP for North Carolina, there are two FERC jurisdictional projects, and only one is seeking a CPCN right now for the Utilities Commission.
So what I think I'm hearing you say is that this commission, in considering whether to grant a merchant plant CPCN, should undertake to review not only the cost, but the complete nature of the upgrades that might be triggered by a proposed merchant plan. Is that right?
It should be taken into consideration, yes.
And that the commission should also review not only the aggregate cost, but the interrelationships among the different projects that might all trigger upgrades in the same cluster, is that right?
It is potential, yes.
That seems like a lot of work. Is that...
But before, is it two projects in Duke Energy Progress seeking FERC jurisdictional interconnection? I don't know how to classify that as a lot of work.
Well, so let me ask you a follow-up question, though. Speaking of the aggregate amount of upgrade costs that might be imposed in the transitional cluster, is there a number, is there a cost, an aggregate cost number that the public staff would deem unreasonable for upgrades coming out of the TCS?
Could you clarify on, again, as I stated earlier, is when you're looking at SP projects, it's done under a slightly different lens comparative to...
Just for jurisdictional. Ignore the SPs. We don't care about those
thank,
right now.
Thank you. So can you repeat the question, please?
So, solely with regard to FERC jurisdictional projects, upgrades that might be ultimately charged in part to North Carolina retail ratepayers, is there an aggregate number that the public staff would consider to be too much, to be unreasonable?
Well, again, we believe that the concept of the LCOT is correct in nature, and it is a possibility once we have the completed facility study from Duke Energy Progress that even the concept of a $4 LCOT may be approved. I cannot make that approval at this point in time because, again, one has to evaluate the facts and circumstances at that particular point in time for that particular application or as to the possibility of a cluster study process, one might need to take a step back and look at it more of a holistic evaluation explicitly when we're starting to look at potential outcomes of the carbon plan that will be implemented over in the coming years.
Okay. All right, I want to think about the logistics of requiring a facility study before a merchant plant can submit a CPCN application. So Juneau is interconnecting under the OAT, not the North Carolina GIP, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So under the OAT, the LGIA, the interconnection agreement, has to be delivered to the customer within 60 days after receipt of the facility study. Is that right?
Subject to check. I've read over the LGIA. I don't have...
You haven't memorized it?
I have not memorized it. I have reviewed it. I have aligned the time periods between that and CIP, but subject to check.
Okay, thank you. I had to reread it last night, so I have not memorized it either. So in the transitional cluster, the customer has to execute the LGIA within 60 days of receiving the draft IA. Is that right?
Subject to check.
Okay, so the customer has a total of 120 days from delivery of the facility study to execute an interconnection agreement.
Up to, yes.
Okay, up to. And signing the interconnection agreement obligates the customer to pay the upfront cost of interconnection facilities for the project and also upgrades. Is that right?
The executed LGIA, yes, it's an agreement between the utility and the applicant. Where I lose track of, I've been spending a lot of my energy here lately on affected systems. I don't know if FERC has to approve that. I don't know.
If you, I'll represent that if you use the pro forma, it just has to be filed, not approved.
Okay, thank you.
So it's the public staff's position, though, that the commission denied the Juneau CPCN without prejudice and that Juneau not be able to refile its application until after it has received its facility study and also affect any affected system studies. Is that right? And I can direct you to page 6 of your testimony if that's helpful.
Can you point to exactly what line?
Sure. So on lines 5 through 9, You say, I recommend that the commission deny the CPC without prejudice, allowing the applicant to refile its application once it has obtained its facility study report and once any applicable network upgrades assigned from affected system studies are known. Did I read that correctly?
That is correct, because that will enable me to initiate the investigation process to evaluate the upgrades, the nature of upgrades, have conversations with the impacted utility, and as well as the applicant, similar to how we had conversations in discovery and Friesian.
So as we discussed, under the oath, a customer has 120 days from the issuance of its facility study to execute its IA, is that right?
Up to, yes.
Okay. In your experience, is it typical for the commission to issue a ruling on a merchant plant CPC and application within 120 days of it being filed?
I'm not cognizant of the dates.
Okay, well, do you recall an instance in which the commission has granted a merchant plant or has taken action to deny or grant a merchant plant CPCN within 120 days of it being filed?
I'm not cognizant of the dates, but I'm trying to understand the relationship between the execution of the LGIA versus the CPCN. Those are, well, I know it's making a linkage. They don't have to be on the same track.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. It's not really practicable for an interconnection customer to get its facility study, prepare a CPCN application, file it, and get a ruling from the commission on its CPCN within 120 days, is it?
I think it was something that had to be taken into consideration, and the applicant could make notification to the commission to take into consideration, not for an accelerated timeline, but a concept of potential priority given whatever is before the commission at that time.
So you could ask for a ruling within 120 days, is that what you're saying?
That's correct.
Okay. But,
and I think this is just a dynamic function of the TCS process, something that we're still learning through.
Okay. But there's not a process in place that would allow a merchant plant to get a CPCN approved or denied within 120 days, is there?
I would have to go back and reread. I don't know if there's a timeline that's preventing something to be truncated. I don't think it says that you have to wait 180 days until you get a ruling.
Well, the commission's got to, there are certain specified timelines, such as the 10-day completion deadline, public notice periods, clearinghouse review, time for testimony, time for hearings if necessary, and all that, right?
That is correct.
Okay, and it's more typical for a CPC and application to take at least, say, 6 months or more than that. Is that a fair characterization?
Potential or one-off anomalies, but usually those were mandated by law.
Okay, so it seems to me extremely unlikely that if a merchant facility weren't able to file its application until after it got its facility study, that it would receive a ruling on a CPCN prior to entering into its IA. Would you agree with that?
Generally agree. And then when looking at the statement on page 6 and turning over to page 4, footnote 29, sort of laid out the timeline here for this very concept. When one looks at the issuance of the facility studies and the potential individual restudies throughout the process, one can see that the multiple 150-day blocks along with prospective timelines, which if the LGIA takes up to 120 days, 120 days is well within the 150 days.
Okay, I'm sorry, Mr. Metz. I did not catch where it is that you're looking.
Oh, sorry. Page 34, footnote 29. So through that footnote, it was generally laying out for illustrative purposes to see the different times of when study reports would be issued, the potential complexities of restudy, but in each circumstance, the window opened for each individual one. We believe it was appropriate that even given with the up to 120 days that there would be time to perform this process under the nature of the TCS process, which was to clear the logjam, I believe it was said today, it was to remove the speculative nature of certain projects and advance commercial-ready projects.
Okay, but I'm looking at footnote 29, and there's no reference to the deadlines for executing an IA here, are there?
That is correct.
Okay, it's this process you've laid out ends in facility study, right?
The individual facility, individual facility study is 150 days, September 27th, 2022 through February 24th, 2023. The issuance of facility studies, and again, in conversations with Duke, this is sort of the back end, if you would. This is sort of the up to. They may be issued before. And then phase three restudy with the additional timeline requirements.
Okay, so you're saying Juno, come back in maybe February 2023 and file your application then? Is that right?
Give or take upon the issuance of a facility study, yes.
Okay. So upon receipt of an application for a CPCN for a project that may have already signed an LGIA, the commission could decide to deny that application, couldn't it?
The commission could or they could accept.
Okay. So fundamentally, the interconnection customer, the merchant facility, does not know whether the commission is going to grant or deny its CPCN when it files its application, right?
That is correct, and I can't make my recommendation to the commission until I see the actual facility study cost by the incumbent utility.
Okay. So is it your belief that a merchant facility should enter into an LGIA and commit itself to funding millions of dollars in upgrades and interconnection facilities without knowing whether this commission will allow it to be constructed?
So there's two concepts here. This is the TCS process, and there's what comes after a TCS process, which is often just referred to as the DISIS. Again, the TCS process and the milestones and the increased payments were completed through a negotiated stakeholder process, which TCS process had higher costs comparative to DISIS for the concept of, as the word has been used today, clearing to logjam, to remove the degree of speculative projects and move forward commercial ready projects. That was all agreed upon through a stakeholder process by two state commissions and the FERC.
Okay, I'm going to ask a question again, because I'm not sure I heard the answer to it. Is it your belief that a merchant facility, either going through TCS or going through DISIS, should be required to enter into an interconnection agreement without knowing whether the commission will allow it to be constructed?
That is a financial risk of the applicant.
So
they have to evaluate the costs or the cost uncertainty at that given point in time.
Okay, so
and I can't speculate on what the applicant would or would not do. So I'm not trying to dodge your question. It's just I can't say what the applicant would or would not do in execution of LGIA. It's just one has to evaluate the knowns and unknowns, and that's in my opinion a business risk that the applicant would need to take whether they want to execute the LGIA. In theory, in speculation, one could enter an LGIA and while waiting for the facility study. If they have a strong understanding of what they believe their transmission costs are, they can enter what they won't enter into. I can't control that.
Okay, but in the absence of guidance from the commission or the public staff on what level of costs are reasonable, how does an interconnection customer make a decision whether or not to enter into an LGIA when they have no idea whether their CPCN is going to be granted or denied?
Mr. Snowden, that's been asked and answered
a couple of
times.
Well, let me ask you this, Mr. Metz. So when an LGIA is executed, the utility's interconnection teams will commence doing engineering work and procuring long lead time materials and ultimately constructing the facilities and upgrades. Is that right?
Per the milestone agreements, for example, one of the items that we noticed in Frisian was the multiple years that it would take for the constructions of certain not critical energy infrastructure, but just critical parts of the system that can only be worked on during certain parts of the season. So that would have to be a factor in that agreement would be the timeline.
Okay, so Duke's personnel should go ahead and commence work on interconnection without knowing whether the project will actually go forward?
That is a business risk that the applicant will enter into with the incumbent utility. That is a business decision between those two parties.
Okay. Do you think that is a good use of Duke's limited construction resources?
If the milestone agreements are to keep Duke Energy cost neutral, when I say cost neutral is they will not expend X amount of cost or resources without being reimbursed, that is a risk-based decision to keep them indifferent.
Okay, understood that Duke may be indifferent to the cost, but would you agree that Duke's own personnel resources are not infinite?
That is correct.
Okay, and that there is in fact a bit of a crunch on Duke's engineering and construction personnel and has been for the last several years?
I can't define crunch, but also know there's been an increase in staffing to address these potential situations.
Okay. Is it your understanding that once an IA is signed, subsequent DISIS clusters will rely on upgrades that are committed through an IA in the baseline for the next study?
I'm trying to go through my mind of saying, okay, is the baseline the actual IA? Because a function of the baseline is the base case, which is already considering future upgrades that are already in the works. So it's not solely based upon the IA. I do not know if it explicitly encompasses the IA or not.
Well, let me ask it another way. Say you've got the DISIS 2023 cluster, and Duke is establishing the base case for that. It's going to consider upgrades that were allocated and committed in the DISIS 2020, in the previous year cluster, right?
Yes, a function of the future DISIS would always be the base case of the, I'm trying to get my vocabulary right here, whatever the entered in contracts with the previous cluster agreed to pay for.
Okay. So wouldn't it cause some pretty significant disruption to other interconnection customers if the commission were to deny a CPCN for a project that had already signed an IA?
It depends. It's very complex in nature because you can have some projects that will not, again, in theory, you'll have some projects interconnecting in parts of the system that would not have any upgrade cost or create these interdependencies. Under some examples, with multiple interdependencies, depending on the magnitude of the interdependencies, there could be complications. But again, complications are just challenges that we continually work and overcome on every given day.
Okay, well, let me narrow the question a little bit. Take as an example a project that does have significant interdependencies and does incur significant upgrade costs, because I think those are the kinds of projects that, you know, we care about or that the public staff cares about. Wouldn't it be pretty disruptive to other interconnection customers and to the DISIS process if the commission were to deny a CPCN for a project like that after it had already signed an IA?
But again, as I stated earlier, I believe that there is enough of a window for once the facility study costs are known, they can be evaluated and be brought forward to this commission and potential for the commission to make their ruling on whether it should be denied or accepted prior to the next DISIS window closing. Because when the DISIS window opens, there's a period of time before the DISIS window closes.
Well, let me ask this. Say you've got, and I'll move on, because I know we spent a long time on this. Wouldn't it cause a lot of disruption to the same cluster that the project was in if the commission were to later deny the CPCN, assuming, again, that the project had significant interdependencies and committed to constructing upgrades?
That's a risk with cluster studies process and with functions being interdependent. I mean, we're seeing that right now in PJM. So that is not a new process, that's something that already exists.
I understood that the risk of project withdrawals is part of a cluster study. Do you think the commission should be doing things to increase the risk of disruption based on more withdrawals?
I don't believe that we are increasing the risk, because again, as stated before, is an order for me or the public staff, and presumably the commission, to make the determination of what the transmission upgrades are. We need to complete a facility study. Looking at the timelines, there is a adequate window, albeit somewhat narrow, to potentially resolve this issue.
Okay, so you say there is an adequate but narrow window after the delivery of the facility study to evaluate those costs, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. But you also recommend that Juno not refile its application until after an affected system study is completed. Is that right?
That is correct, and that's one of the concerns that we did bring up during the stakeholder process as well, in our comments that we filed, is that the affected system study is somewhat, it's not isolated, but it is in its own parallel path without explicit timeline. So as the applicant moves through its process, for example, if a project goes into phase one and they get identified of, hypothetically, you're locating a Duke Energy Progress and under an affected system under phase one, Duke Energy Progress will notify DEC, hey, you're an affected system. What do you want to do about it? So through the LGI process, Duke Energy Carolinas will say, all right, we're going to go evaluate it. Why the transition cluster and DISIS are moving forward at their own pace. I mean, some of this has also been brought up in much detail through the resource solicitation cluster. Is that Duke Energy Carolinas could notify them to say, well, while you triggered an affected system, there really wasn't nothing there. It was no cost, or it was something very, very nebulous. However, what the applicant is also informed in both of phase one and phase two, it's a flag. It's a risk. You have the potential for affected system upgrades. With that known risk, do you want to continue to move forward with paying your deposits and potential penalties with the offset provisions if costs go greater than 25%? There's ways out and the penalties be waived. So yes, the affected system process does go in its own path, but it's informing the applicant, not at facility study, well in advance of facility study, phase one, phase two, and that's a business risk that they're making throughout the entire process.
Okay, so would you agree that there are no defined timelines for the delivery of affected system studies?
Correct.
Okay, and I believe you testified that Duke has a what it calls a goal of completing affected system studies within 60 to 90 days, and I'm sorry, that's on page 25 of your testimony.
That's correct.
Okay, 60 to 90 days from when?
I would have to go back and reread the LGIA through the affected system process.
Okay, but that 60 to 90 days is just a goal, right?
It is a goal.
Okay, and we have no commitments from any other utility about how long it might take them to conduct an affected system study, do we?
That's correct. For example, if Juno Solar was to trigger a PJM affected system process, you're at PJM's discretion of when that affected system study process would or would not be completed, no different than any other potential utility.
Okay, so there's really no telling when a project might receive an affected system study?
Yes.
Okay, it could certainly be after the facility study was received, right?
It could be. Yes, it could very well be. But so in that conversation or in that vein would be, we might be able to get preliminary information and serve discovery on the affected utility to say, okay, what was the nature of the upgrade? It's a substation breaker. All right, $1 million. Okay, we can evaluate that. The explicits of it would have to be more fine-tuned through the affected system study. But if at a preliminary or high level, then we have those conversations, say, well, we really have about 55 miles of 230 kV that we need to upgrade, and we have this other section, 115, yada, yada, yada. It changes the story, and the applicant will have to evaluate those risks as they move through the process. So if the applicant is notified of affected system at phase one, they could bow out without the penalties, and that would be potentially, fair isn't the right word, but the other people in the queue can continue to evaluate, because maybe that magnitude of that project was the tipping point that triggered the affected system, and the rest of the projects may be able to come under the triggering effect. So it's not going to necessarily implode. It's a function that continue has to be evaluated and restudied.
Okay, so your recommendation, though, is that merchant projects, or that FERC jurisdictional customers, wait until they receive their affected system studies before they file a CPC and application?
That would be consistent with the EMP applications, because I could not make my determination of what the nature of those upgrades are, nor the cost, because now we come in a potential. So let's say hypothetically, Juno Solar triggers an affected system upgrade in DEC. So public staff would have to evaluate, and it's under the FERC crediting policy. We would have to evaluate the impacts, not now just to only DEP customers. We would have to evaluate the impacts now to DEC customers for energy that is going into, again, hypothetically, not trying to single out Juno, but for, again, hypothetically, where something is getting sold into PJM.
So it's your position that an interconnection customer should wait to receive an affected system study from PJM or Santee Cooper or Dominion or a non-North Carolina utility prior to filing a CPC and application?
I think that would be the most ideal solution. And when one considers the termination provision of the LCOT, I don't see them any different. So under the assumption that if a merchant power plant was seeking a CPC in from the Utilities Commission and they had an unknown affected system cost but was applied to the overall LCOT, I don't see the difference of getting a $4, in my words, a blank check paying all the upgrades, or not paying for the upgrades, but potentially paying for the study, being exposed to the withdrawal penalties, only up to multiple months down the road or years down the road, and be notified of this open-ended affected system process.
So I think you mentioned the possibility of, you know, what would happen if Juno triggered affected system impacts on DEC. So Ms. Miller testified in her rebuttal that Juno has committed not to seek reimbursement from North Carolina ratepayers for any affected system costs. Did you hear that?
I agree with that, and that's some of the fluid nature that has been discussed over time through the testimony. So part of that would make sure, I mean, the devil's in the details. If one were to make it a condition, I mean, I think the condition would have to be explicit that the LCOT does not apply towards affected system cost. Affected system cost that the applicant is voluntarily requesting that they pay for their own upgrades in an affected system.
So if there were a condition in Juno's CPCN that provided that Juno would not seek reimbursement for any affected system costs, upgrade costs that would be charged to North Carolina ratepayers, would that resolve the public staff's concerns about affected system upgrade costs?
In terms of the recommendation that the public staff would need to review both the facility study and the affected system costs, that may be, I would have to think on it more, but that very may be a mitigation measure, as you discussed.
Okay. And if Juno were to trigger affected system upgrades on PJM system, they would not get reimbursement for those in any event, would they?
That is my current understanding, yes.
Okay. Are there any other systems that Juno might trigger affected system upgrades on?
I have the transmission map in mind, so I'm trying to evaluate it. It would be too much speculation to make any assumptions at this time without fully understanding the sort of the base case or the potential retirements or what they're referred to as defects on what elements are turned down in the system to handle the injection of the new generation. Too much speculation.
Okay, thank you. But Juno would not in any event be getting a reimbursement of affected system upgrade costs from North Carolina ratepayers, is that right? if it accepted the condition that, that we just discussed a minute ago.
Under that condition, with that explicit caveat, yes.
Okay, thank you. So let's move on a little bit. Mr. Metz, in your testimony, you discuss HB 951, is that right?
Generally, yes.
Okay. And that law requires the commission to take all reasonable steps to reduce emissions from Duke's generating fleet in North Carolina by 70% by 2030, is that right?
In part, there's a couple provisions of that. Under certain technologies, there is a little bit of a grace period. I don't have the law in front of me. Subject to tech, I believe it was a year or two under certain provisions. And there was one other caveat, but go ahead.
Okay. So Ms. Miller testifies that with regard to HB 951, that Duke's IRP, which the commission has now approved, shows that achieving this goal of 70% reduction would require procuring at least 9 gigawatts of solar by 2030. Does that sound right to you?
If you can point me to her testimony, please.
Sure. Page, let's see, this is her, 15, I'm sorry, I think it's her direct testimony, page 15. I'm sorry, that's her rebuttal testimony, page 15.
All right, page 15, the question starts on 14.
Line 16 is the testimony.
So yeah, please proceed.
Okay, so she says Duke's integrated resource plan pending before the commission shows that amount of solar that must be procured to be at least 9 gigawatts, although interveners have put on evidence that would support a much higher number. Do you agree that she's appropriately characterizing the IRP and what others have said in the IRP docket?
Well, somewhat confused on the, I mean, she jumps, and not on purposely, but I couldn't discern to whether she was talking about the North Carolina IRP or the South Carolina IRP. I know she talks about sort of at the last line, the amount of required solar could be closer to 11 gigawatts, so that would point to me that she was referencing South Carolina's IRP and not necessarily North Carolina's IRP. And I remember the other caveat that I wanted to eventually discuss, that 951 is that the commission has to create, implement, and follow through on the clean carbon plan or that equivalent. And that would inform the steps and evaluation steps on the generation portfolio that would be into the future, which I would hope that, or at least the public staff would also be evaluating the NREL Phase 2 report, which would be evaluating the amount of potential generation resources to complement the existing system while balancing the retirement of the existing systems to maximize efficient utility build out on both generation and transmission.
Okay. Well, would you agree that based on this 9 gigawatt number that was included in Duke's North Carolina IRP, Duke would need to add at least a gigawatt of solar per year through 2030, and maybe more, to reach the decarbonization goals of HB 951? Do you agree with that?
No, I don't necessarily agree with that, because now I don't know if she's mixing Duke Energy Carolinas or Duke Energy Progress, or she's looking at the joint study case, which is generally just sort of a hypothetical because they are two independent VAs. I don't know if you can provide any more discretion on that, because Duke Energy Progress has a magnitude greater, I don't know, I can't recite the exact numbers, of solar generation above Duke Energy Carolinas.
Okay, I'll represent to you that Ms. Miller is, I believe, speaking collectively of the two utilities. Do those numbers sound right when considered in the context of both utilities?
I didn't happen to know which portfolio, because under portfolio A, no new solar generation. I believe I did file testimony on this, but no new solar generation was economically selected on portfolio A, respecting that at that point in time in the 2020 IRP, we did not have HB 951.
Okay.
I need to give our court reporter a break. So how much longer do you anticipate questioning?
I would say, and I will try to trim it down, but I say I have about an hour left. I'll try to go a little, I will, if we have a break, I will try to trim that down to get
okay, well, and y'all also may need to talk about, I mean, we have to leave at 5, so look at other dates potentially that we can come back. So I think we've identified December 8th as a potential date, so if you, if all the parties could discuss that date during the break. We're going to go off the record. We'll be back on at 4 p.m.